neighborhood is covered with black soot.
The EPA investigates a coal-fired power plant in downtown Fairbanks. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, February 6th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, two men are sentenced to life in prison without parole for torturing and murdering a man.
It really affected the family, you know. My mom is always crying every morning for this.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Every Alaskan can make a difference when we file online for our PFD. You can shelter families in crisis, nourish the hungry and homeless, and protect those who have suffered abuse and neglect. And it's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give. And good things will happen for the causes you care about. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and BP.
By a vote of 75 to 20, the U.S. Senate passed the bill that reauthorizes the Federal Aviation Administration for 4 years. Before the vote, Democrat Mark Begich spoke of the importance of money for runway improvements, upgrades to air traffic control systems, and the vital nature of air travel in Alaska, where he said more than 80% of communities are off the road system.
This conference report makes significant investments in the Essential Air Service Program, otherwise known as EAS, which serves rural and isolated areas. 44 communities in Alaska will continue to receive minimal level of scheduled passenger service. Sensible reforms that will exclude communities in the lower 48 with fewer than 10 passengers per day.
Senator Murkowski joined Begich in supporting the bill. The legislation passed the House last week. Today's passage by the Senate is significant. Begich says since 2003, there have been 23 short-term extensions for the FAA. The reauthorization runs through 2015 and allocates $15.9 billion annually for all sorts of runway and airport improvements, construction projects, and modernization of the air traffic control system. Begich denounced controversial rules that were added to the legislation that affects the ability of unions to organize. Now, 50% of a company's employees would have to want a vote to vote on union representation rather than 35%. Begich says the language had no place in the bill, but he said it was time to move on and get the reauthorization passed. The Environmental Protection Agency is investigating a coal-fired power plant in downtown Fairbanks to determine whether it's the source of a messy and possibly hazardous dust that blankets the area. The investigation could lead to a designation as a federal Superfund cleanup site. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
EPA officials have decided to take a second and more detailed look at the source of the black dust in and around the Aurora Energy Power Plant after an initial survey of the area completed last month showed evidence that hazardous substances are present at a high enough level to warrant further investigation. An EPA spokeswoman told KUAC on Friday that investigators have not concluded for certain that the power plant is the source of the black dust found around the facility and surrounding residential area. The spokeswoman said that will be determined as the investigation continues. But residents of the area around the facility formerly known as the Chena Power Plant don't have any doubt that it's where the fine black stuff that blankets the area comes from.
You know, I would invite anyone to take a walk, and you can see this with your own eyes. It's very obvious.
That's Perry Schneider. He lives about a block away from the plant at 1204 First Avenue, right on the banks of the Chena River. Schneider says he and many of his neighbors suspect the black fallout comes mainly from the dump trucks that haul ash out of the plant up to six times a day. Schneider and his wife, Barbara, both say they've been putting up with it ever since they moved in 18 years ago.
The neighborhood is covered with black soot, and you can go over to the power plant, and you can see where the trucks drive in and out, and you can see this black soot all over the place.
The EPA's Superfund investigation was initiated in May when Teresa De Lima, a Fairbanks native, filed a citizen's petition with the agency after what she says was years of dealing with coal ash and dust while living in a house near the plant. De Lima says she moved her parents into the house 10 years ago, and soon thereafter they began suffering health problems that she and doctors who treated them strongly suspect were caused by the coal ash and dust. De Lima says she's since moved her parents out of the house. She declined to talk further about the issue on the record. A top corporate officer with Aurora Energy also declined to speak on tape about the issue. Yusubeli says Aurora has all required permits and operates within state and federal laws. He says the complaints are motivated by their anti-coal agenda, intended to put pressure on Aurora to shut down the plant and cripple the coal industry. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Jeffrey Hout of Bethel and Harry Williams of Queethluck will never be free men again after receiving life sentences Friday in Bethel Superior Court. Both men were sentenced to 104 years without parole for torturing and killing 19-year-old Benjamin Kaiser of Hooper Bay. As a warning to our listeners, this story includes a graphic description of the crime. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
The sentence was decided by Fairbanks Judge Michael McDonald, who presided over the trial in October. At the beginning of the hearing, the court heard an emotional testimony from Kaiser's aunt, Teresa Smith.
It really affected the family. You know, my mom is always crying every morning for this. I can't stand to listen to her cry every morning when I get up over my nephew, Benjamin, and my brother.
Kaiser's father passed away in December. They say his son's death put him over the edge. Smith told the court the family wanted more than 99 years. They wanted life in prison, and that's what the state asked for. District Attorney June Stein argued for four aggravators: deliberate cruelty, vulnerable victim, dangerous instrument, and most serious offense. Stein asked the court to prohibit discretionary parole.
The only thing that's going to protect the public, Your Honor, is a maximum sentence.
On the other side, both defenders tried to separate their clients. Williams' attorney, Carla Taylor Welch, said that Hout was the leader and Williams was just doing what he was told. She said that Williams had, quote, limited mental functioning, which led to his criminal history and Kaiser's death. Williams read from a written statement saying he was under Hout's control.
I depend on him for a place to stay and food and help him work at all the times. He would tell me what to do, like, I have to do that.
Hout's defender, Lori Bodwell, said that her client had a clean record compared to Williams and argued for a sentence that would have had Hout up for parole in about 16 years. She argued that life would be too severe for their second-degree murder case, calling it middle of the road.
Frankly, a middle of the road murder to alcohol-induced fight.
It is not a mid-range murder two. It is not a mid-range kidnapping.
That's Judge Michael McDonald, who rejected all efforts by the defense seeking leniency. He accepted all four aggravators by the state and said the men needed to be in jail for life because they posed an extreme danger to the public.
The gross disregard of the inevitable reality of beating a person in that position as much as Ben was beaten is enough to infer an intent to kill. Indeed, it's inexplicable unless there is an intent to kill.
Kaiser had been tied up to a table saw, whipped with cords, beaten with an angle iron, and sanded with a hand sander for approximately 6 hours. McDonald called it unrelenting savagery. In his own written statement, Hout apologized to the whole YK Delta, and particularly to the Kaiser family.
No words can really express my sorrow for the loss of your beloved son and brother, Ben Kaiser. I am truly very, very sorry for my actions on that fateful morning.
After the sentencing, Ben Kaiser's sister, Jennifer Nanning, said the family was satisfied with the results.
I feel better. My dad would have been happy enough for those, you know, those guys that murdered my brother. He would have been, you know, happy for those guys that's going to spend their whole life in jail.
In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, recognizing a war hero decades after his service.
It was hardcore. I mean, it was a high-intensity combat unit, and I never really thought of myself as expendable. But at the time, that's just the way it worked.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. And by the Statewide BP Teachers of Excellence Program. Nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. Nominations are due by February 14th.
Legislators today looked at an initiative likely to be on the ballot later this year that would reestablish a coastal management program. The previous program was allowed to close last summer as lawmakers and the administration could not agree on the terms of extending it. Initiative sponsor Juneau Mayor Bruce Botello told a joint meeting of the House and Senate Judiciary Committees that with the measure, coastal communities are recognizing that the federal law that set up the state program gives Alaskans a voice over the federal government. He said the state currently does not have the right to review any federal activity and that federal agencies are not now submitting their plans to the state. He also said that the program is important to local landowners and developers because of its role in coordinating permitting activities. He says that accelerates rather than delays projects that come before it.
That function has been paramount to the program since, and it's certainly incorporated into our initiative as well. That is to make sure that an individual developer does not have to be in a situation that he or she or it has to go to each agency individually, try and sort out the regulatory scheme for that agency, work that timeline, go to the next agency, and do the same thing.
The hearing was held as a requirement for all initiatives and no decision or action was necessary. The legislature may take action on the same subject, however, if a bill that is substantially similar passes this year, voters would not need to act on the initiative. Director of Elections Gail Fanumiai told the Joint Committee that she expects to have a decision on whether to certify the initiative in 2 weeks. This week, some lawmakers will meet to discuss department mission statements. One topic will be changes to the Department of Natural Resources mission statement in January. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
Anchorage Republican Representative Mia Costello is the chair of the House DNR Budget Subcommittee. She says legislators will be taking a closer look at the changes to DNR's mission statement this week.
Yes, I will bring it up, and I did want to mention that every budget subcommittee is hinging our hat on the mission statement of the department. We're really looking at that. So it will come up and we will address it.
The change caught some legislators by surprise when Commissioner Dan Sullivan presented it to them in a House Resources Committee meeting January 20th.
We've kind of revised our mission statement a little bit to simplify it and actually what we think syncing up much more closely to what the constitutional mandate is. In the past year, we actually expanded, I don't know if in the budgeting process, we had kind of two core services. We've expanded those core services to four, and we believe that's a better reflection of what all the different directors do. So we've been working on kind of our responsibilities to the citizens of Alaska and how we interpret that through mission and core services.
To Commissioner Sullivan's explanation of the mission change, Republican Representative Paul Seaton replied,
"The mission statement, I appreciate you saying that that was changed, but it seems to be quite a different direction. I mean, the current mission statement has been to develop, conserve, enhance the natural resources for present and future Alaskans. And with the new one, all future Alaskans basically are out of it, and it looks like it's by making them available for maximum use and benefit consistent with public interest, but it seems to be quite a different emphasis."
Commissioner Sullivan issued the change on January 17th. The words conserve and enhance have been dropped, along with the reference to future Alaskans. That change bothers Anchorage Democratic Representative Berta Gardner.
He basically says that conserve is implied in the new mission statement because it says maximum benefit, which also, according to him, means for future generations, too. I'm not sure that I agree with that.
Representative Gardner ordered a research report and a legal opinion from the Legislative Legal Department. The opinion confirms that it is the job of the legislature to set agency missions. But if a mission is changed by a department and the legislature fails to object, it qualifies as tacit approval. Last week at a press conference in the Capitol, Governor Sean Parnell spoke out in support of Commissioner Sullivan's decision and confirmed he played a role in the changes to the mission statement.
Yes, I certainly had a role in that mission statement, because that mission statement comes straight out of Alaska's Constitution for Department of Natural Resources. It is Article 8, Section 1 of the Constitution. I thought the Constitution was a pretty good foundation for a department's mission. But I think if you will read that statement of policy from the Constitution, even though it doesn't expressly mention that conservation element, it's implied in the terms of that section.
The DNR was not the only department to change its mission this year. Missions for the Department of Transportation and for the governor also changed. Representative Gardner's staff confirmed the research report and legal opinion have been passed on to Representative Costello, and that the hearing is set on the issue for Tuesday. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The University of Alaska Anchorage is $1 million richer today thanks to a gift from BP. The money is for the UAA School of Engineering to establish a corrosion and mechanical integrity laboratory, something that has been lacking in the state up until now. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
BP Exploration Alaska President John Minjay announced the gift at a meeting of the National Association of Corrosion Engineers International in Anchorage.
For the university, this gift will create a sustainable facility. And it'll be sustainable because it will expand the university's corrosion engineering curriculum. It's going to dramatically increase the capability of integrity testing here in Alaska instead of having to send stuff outside.
The new lab is expected to be ready by fall. It will enable UAA's mechanical engineering program to expand its corrosion engineering curriculum and will provide hands-on training for future engineers. Matt Cullen is an assistant engineering professor at UAA who will be directing the new facility.
All it took was me coming in and pitching this idea, and it was obviously something that was a huge need, because as soon as I started touching on these, what it would provide the industry, what it would provide to our students, I mean, the interest level just shot through the roof.
As North Slope infrastructure ages, recent corrosion problems have highlighted a need for corrosion engineers. Cullen says the lab will enable data to be studied in Alaska, not in Houston.
When I came up here and started hearing about a lot of the corrosion issues, I picked up the one corrosion course that we have. And, you know, the more I looked at it, the more I thought, you know, why are these tests being sent out of the state? Why are they sending failure analysis stuff off to Houston to be tested, or, you know, outsourcing stuff down to the lower 48? It just didn't make sense to me. We have this great university, a booming engineering program. Why aren't we doing it here? Sometimes all it takes is one person to just ask the question, and that's enough.
Cullen says the lab will be useful not only for the oil and gas industry, but for aviation, shipping, and water and wastewater facilities. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation celebrates four decades of dependable financing and competitive interest rates for Alaskans. Find out more by asking your lender or real estate professional how Alaska Housing can assist you with buying a home. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD. Also, paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Anchorage hotel workers are celebrating after a federal judge issued a preliminary injunction against Remington Hospitality, the Texas-based operator of the city's Sheraton Hotel. The injunction comes after a three-year legal battle. It requires the Sheraton take steps to restore the terms and conditions of employment as they existed prior to the hotel's decision to stop union negotiations in 2009. Faye Gavin, a banquet server with 24 years with the Sheraton, says she joined the lawsuit after management started doing things like cutting lunch breaks, increasing workload, and giving away hours to temporary workers. The injunction, she says, is a step in the right direction.
With this injunction, we're going to get our seniority back. With seniority, hopefully some of us will have an income again. And then down the road, the fired employees hopefully will be coming back. We hope to get back and get a contract, a fair contract, and have respect again.
A federal judge issued the injunction against Remington on February 3rd. In a statement to APRN, Remington Lodging and Hospitality attorney Carl Terrell said the group planned to appeal the injunction. The union claims that over 30 unfair labor practice charges are still pending against the Anchorage Sheraton. Local 878 represents over 1,400 hospitality workers across the state of Alaska. The early leaders in this year's quest headed out of the Circle City checkpoint over 200 miles into the race onto the frozen Yukon River this morning. Veterans Hugh Neff, Brent Sass, Abby West, Alan Moore, and Sonny Lindner, and rookie Jake Berkowitz hit the trail within about 2 hours of one another between 8 and 10:15 this morning. From Circle, the trail runs 160 miles up the Yukon to the next checkpoint at Eagle, but there are several cabins and Slavin's Dog Drop to rest at in between. KYC's Emily Schwing has more from Circle.
At the firehouse in Circle, mushers are looking a little haggard, but it's mostly due to lack of sleep. Otherwise, they've had a dry and warm run into the checkpoint. But Brent Sass says there is one thing that hasn't changed about Birch Creek.
It didn't get any shorter. It's always a really long run on Birch Creek, and it seemed really long again. But the dogs were real good, and they got better as we went.
One musher that's taking advantage of a good weather report and a trail lacking overflow is Abby West.
It's almost like playing poker or any card game. You're dealt a hand. So I have a good hand, but sometimes it matters the way you play it to be successful. And I feel like so far I've done everything, done all the right plays to be in the place that I want to be.
West likes to call herself Abby Quest, having started the race twice and finished once before. She pieced together a series of impressive runs to place herself near the front of the pack. She and her handler, Jake Hadzow, have decided her team will try to stay up front, but she won't start racing yet.
Leaving here, I do have a game plan. It's not totally out of the question, but I don't know if I'm in it to win it this year.
Alan Moore is also trying to run a more competitive race his second time around, but his dogs haven't been in the same mindset.
The dogs just seem they don't want to go uphill or up steep hills. And it must have something to do with last year with the high winds and everything they had to endure. Because ever since then, they start looking around and go straight down.
Moore's team may fare better on the flat and wide Yukon River. Teams meet the river just after they leave from the Circle checkpoint. They'll likely encounter beaver dams, tight corners, deep snow, and jumble ice. Reporting from the Yukon Quest Trail in Circle, I'm Emily Schwing.
A Fairbanks man has been awarded the military's third highest honor. Retired Staff Sergeant Paul Taylor was decorated with the Silver Star at a ceremony Saturday at Fort Wainwright. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the medal is in recognition of Taylor's bravery during a battle 45 years ago in Vietnam.
The long-ago valor of Staff Sergeant Paul Taylor had been lost in history until recently, when friends and family contacted the office of U.S. Senator Mark Begich and the military. That culminated in an award ceremony at Fort Wainwright. The Army set the scene by playing a video of images and sounds from the Vietnam War.
Right now. No kidding.
The video included the photo of a fresh-faced young Sergeant Taylor. Taylor, now a gray and balding but healthy man of 68, did not take to the podium to speak at the event, but had his daughter thank those, including former soldiers he served with, for bringing to light his war deeds of so many years ago.
I have a lot of memories from those days. They're not necessarily bad, but very intense, which is why I had my daughter read the statement rather than trying to do it myself.
Taylor's daughter, Dr. Laura Joanna Taylor, read a statement from her father thanking those who facilitated the belated Silver Star Award. She also read from an award citation which described her father's bravery during a 1967 battle in which Sergeant Taylor and his fellow soldiers were vastly outnumbered by Viet Cong in taking machine gun fire.
Sergeant Taylor led a stand-up assault on the enemy machine gun position to silence the weapon. Both Sergeant Taylor and the soldier next to him were wounded during the assault. Almost immediately, Sergeant Taylor's element began to receive automatic weapons fire from a different location. Although Sergeant Taylor was seriously wounded and bleeding profusely, He directed suppressing fire from his supporting element and was able to effectively withdraw and assist the wounded soldier to obtain cover.
The citation goes on to describe how the wounded Sergeant Taylor remained in radio contact to provide essential intelligence that forced the Viet Cong to be routed from their position. U.S. Army Alaska Major General Raymond Palumbo called Taylor the real deal, a true American hero.
At the moment of greatest danger, when bullets were flying and your buddies needed you, you made an instantaneous decision. You made a decision to do something impossible for most of us to comprehend here. And that's why we're here today, to pin on an award on your chest that's been long, long overdue.
Palumbo described Taylor's leadership and bravery as legendary among the Chinese soldiers he was in charge of in Vietnam. Taylor volunteered for service at a time when many soldiers were drafted. Taylor, the recipient of several other medals, including a prior Silver Star, is now a retired University of Alaska Fairbanks business professor. Taylor says he chose Special Forces because as a young man, he was eager for adventure. He says the small recon team he worked on was called the One a Month Club because they were losing a soldier every month.
It was hardcore. I mean, it was a high-intensity combat unit, and I never really thought of myself as expendable. But at the time, that's just the way it worked.
Taylor says he was the baby in a group of highly skilled soldiers who'd served many tours as far back as World War II. He says he lost touch with the men he served with after he was injured and evacuated out of the war zone.
After I got shot, I spent 9 months in Fitzsimmons General Hospital and completely dropped off the map and lost all contact, and most of them thought I was dead. And I thought some of them were dead. And then about 6 years ago, I went to my first ever Army reunion. And lo and behold, you know, there they were.
Taylor says he now stays in touch through email and twice yearly reunions. He says the Army experience resulted in good things in his subsequent life. He married a nurse at the hospital where he recovered and later got an education through the Army that led to a doctorate in economics and a career as a university professor. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Tim Ellis in Delta, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Dacia Eaton and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Emily Schwing on the Yukon Quest Trail, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com,
and by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Subsistence is a significant part of the lives of many Alaskans. If it's important to you, consider applying for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide vital information to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. The deadline to apply is February 17th. Call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.